from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. California contract or freelance workers may now receive benefits afforded to employees, such as workers' compensation, paid sick days, and family leave. Yesterday, California legislators passed a bill, AB 5, which dramatically expands employee status to many workers currently working as independent contractors. Here's the bill's author, Lorena Gonzalez.
If you think there are a lot of homeless people on the street today, let every job be hired through an app and have no rules. The proposals put forward by tech companies are laughable.
Yesterday, Uber said the law does not apply to its business and would not reclassify drivers as employees. We'll get the latest next. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Yesterday, California legislators passed AB 5, which dramatically expands employee status to many workers who are currently classified as independent contractors. The law, which requires companies to provide their workers with the benefits and labor protections of employees, now heads to the governor, who has already signaled his support. Yesterday, Uber said the law does not apply to its business and would not reclassify drivers as employees. In this hour, we explain what's in the bill, and we want to hear from you. What are your questions about these changes to the gig economy or how your industry will be affected? You can call us now at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Joining us to explain AB 5 is Katie Orr, politics and government reporter for KQED. Welcome, Katie.
Hi, Michael.
Hi. And we also have in studio with us Vina Dubal. She's associate professor of law at UC Hastings College of Law, and welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. Glad to have you both with us. Later in the hour, we'll be talking to a staff attorney for the National Federation of Independent Business, Small Business Legal Center. And let me go first to you, Katie, and let's find out what this is all about. Let's want to do a real kind of thorough explainer here. There are perhaps about 1 million people, according to the New York Times, who may be affected by this bill. So it's pretty considerable in its effect and its possible impact. And I wanted just to have you outline for us what this means to reclassify contract workers as employees.
Well, the bill stems from a 2018 California Supreme Court decision involving the Dynamex company. And it essentially says that it replaces the test that California used to use to determine whether someone was a contractor or an employee with a different test, an ABC test. And there are three criteria in that, that if you meet those, then you are an employee versus a contractor. And I think the most important thing to take away from that is that the court ruled if you are someone performing a core function for a business, for instance, you know, if you're a driver for Lyft, you are considered an employee versus a contractor because driving is at the core of Lyft's business. And obviously, this has huge implications for a lot of these gig companies who depend on a contractor model to get their work done, you know, like DoorDash contracts with people to bring you your food and Instacart contracts with people to go grocery shopping for you. They've all been using a contractor model. Under this law, they would have to switch to an employee-based model, which gives the workers access to things like paid leave and sick time and unemployment insurance. But it also would be very costly for these companies to have to suddenly start providing these benefits, and it would upend their whole business model.
They'd have to pay for unemployment insurance and workers' comp, basically, for their employees, right?
Exactly. Things they don't have to pay for now because technically these are contractors and not full-fledged employees of these companies.
So Uber is refusing, or at least is on record as refusing, and at this point it looks like it's going to be tied up in court, but the governor is expected to sign it?
Yeah, the governor has, on Labor Day, he wrote an op-ed in the Sacramento Bee stating that he supports this bill, and it is on his way to his desk. It's on the way to his desk. He is in a kind of tricky position because he receives a lot of support, financial support in his campaigns from the tech industry. And it's not a group he really wants to make angry. In the final weeks of the legislature, we saw him trying to kind of negotiate with specifically Uber and Lyft about maybe getting a carve out in this bill for tech companies, because the bill does offer a lot of exemptions to a lot of other professions, but it didn't go anywhere. And so I think it'll be interesting to me to see if he has like a big splashy signing ceremony for this, because it's a huge deal for like labor groups. But I don't know if he'd want to draw that much attention to it and risk like angering the tech companies.
Well, as the bill is written, it could cost businesses about $6 billion by some estimates. So we're talking about a lot of money here. And there was a hell of a lot of lobbying on this from all kinds of groups, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah. It's been a really active, especially end of session, when they got back from their summer recess in mid-August. We've had protests at the Capitol every week, you know, truckers who had a lot of issues with this bill driving around the Capitol, honking their horns, blaring their horns for an hour, Uber drivers and Lyft drivers for the bill, blocking traffic in front of the Capitol and honking, people against the bill holding huge rallies. And that is just what we see. Of course, there's furious behind the scenes lobbying from all of these, not only the tech companies, but other professions who are worried about how this could affect them, trying to get last minute exemptions from the bill. For instance, newspapers in the final weeks became really concerned about how their delivery people would be affected, because people who deliver your newspaper in the morning are contractors, not employees. And so we saw a big push from newspapers to get an exemption for them.
Yeah, there are a lot of groups that want exemptions in this, and there are a lot of groups that are affected by this. And since you mentioned newspapers, Lorena Gonzalez said, we'll try to work something out, for example, that would allow somebody who wants to, say, write an article for the New York Times to be able to do that. This is now essentially her legislation, and she's authored it. And we'll find out more about what the legislation means, and we'll go to you, our callers, and so forth. But first, let me go to Vina Dubal, who's here with us in studio, who's associate professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law. And by the way, let me just say one other thing with you, if I may, Katie. Drivers work is outside the usual course of Uber's business. That's what Uber is arguing. They're serving as a technology platform for several different types of digital marketplaces. What about that argument, Professor Dubal?
My legal opinion is that is a preposterous argument. You know, just as if you think of Uber, what is the first thing you think of, Mr. Krasny?
What is the first thing I think of? I think of looking at, I think of all kinds of things. We just had Mike Isaac on. No, we just had Mike Isaac on and talked about the book that he had just written, a tech writer for the New York Times on Uber. So lots of things come to mind, but I know what you're thinking. So I think you can tell me what you thought I was thinking.
I think you're thinking that they're a company that transports bodies from one place to another. Without Uber drivers, there is no Uber. The drivers are core to the business. So I think that they're, you know, with the exception of Tony West and maybe some attorneys inside Uber, I don't think anyone else really agrees with that argument. That said, they're also making the argument that not only that AB 5 doesn't apply to them, but that that they're going to have a referendum on the matter. So they're kind of have, you know, I think that they realize that is not a strong legal argument.
Well, let's hear what Tony West has to say.
Driver's work is outside the usual course of Uber's business, which is serving as a technology platform for several different types of digital marketplaces.
Of course, I think it's important to say the workers are split on this. A lot of the workers like the shifts they have.
Right. So, you know, I do ethnographic research amongst Uber drivers, and although the survey data suggests that most drivers want to be independent contractors, when you actually do in-depth interviews with drivers, you learn that it's not that they don't want benefits. It's not that they don't want protections. They're worried about what a notorious exploitative company might do to them if they were actually employees of that company. And so, you know, I don't think drivers are split on on what comes out of this bill. I think drivers want a minimum wage. I think drivers want unemployment insurance. They want workers' compensation. What they're worried about is, well, what else will Uber and Lyft do? And it's important to say that anything else that Uber and Lyft do or any of these gig companies do is not a requirement of the law. There is nothing about the law that says that just because you're an employee, you have to work a shift schedule. I'm an employee. I don't work a shift. I'm guessing that you also don't work a shift. And taxi workers who were employees during the 1970s did not always work shifts. And so it is possible to maintain flexibility and to have basic protections.
The fear is that they will indeed establish a shift. But I'm wondering what your response is to Tony West's remark that this is they serve as a technology platform for different types of digital marketplaces.
Well, they've tried to make this argument since they faced lawsuits beginning around 2015. They've made it in courts across the world, not just in the U.S. And they've lost in large part because while they are essentially a centralized dispatch company that does make this technology, they also set prices on the app. They also incentivize hours on the app. They have rules and regulations for drivers on the app. They can terminate people on the app. So they do much more than just provide a software. If drivers were able to set their own prices, if they were able to not have sort of this incentive-based structure, if they didn't have sort of spurious termination, I think that his argument would be more weighty.
Let me bring our callers in because lots of callers want to let us know what they think. And Steve, we begin with you. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Well, I do agree that Uber and Lyft are quite parasitic. I live in San Francisco and drive around for a living. I do sales, and I wonder how this might affect me. I'm a 1099 employee, get paid 100% on commission, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. We thank you for the call. Can you fill in on that, Katie Orr, for us?
Well, I think it probably is complicated. If he does sales for a company, like I don't know what he sells. Let's say he sells printers for a printer company, and they treat him as a contractor. He may be able to argue that he is providing an essential service, a core service to their business, selling the products that they make, and he might have to be reclassified as an employee. If he sort of has like his own business, there is still room in this for businesses to kind of contract with each other, subcontract, things like that. For instance, we were talking a lot about Uber drivers and whether their drivers are employees or contractors. But the issue is like if Uber needs a plumber to come fix something in their building, then that's okay. They can still contract out that plumber to come fix something in their building because it's not a core service. So it really gets back to what exactly he's selling and what relationship it has to the business that he is working with.
I'll tell you, somebody has put us onto the fact that the temp agencies are marketing like crazy now in light of this. Let me go back to you, Professor DeBallon, from a tweet from Reynolds. It says, AB5 will disenfranchise parents with kids like me who supplement our income with occasional Uber, Lyft, Waze, and DoorDash tickets. 1099 is the way to go.
So again, there is. I assume that the person who's tweeting is the driver, is the worker. He's not using Uber, Lyft, or DoorDash to help in his parenting. So given if this person needs flexible employment, I'm not sure that he's going to lose it. What I've heard is that Uber and Lyft might move to some kind of like they did in New York City. They started logging people off the app during periods of low demand. And drivers don't necessarily want to drive during periods of low demand anyway. Who wants to sit in their car for an hour and not get a single fare? I think that this business model is based on an oversupply of drivers and their flexibility. If this gentleman leaves, or I assume it's a gentleman, if this gentleman leaves Uber and Lyft and stops working for them, lots of people are going to stop working for them, and the companies are not going to be able to survive. And so I am skeptical that they're going to move in that direction.
I just have to ask a quick legal question, though. If companies decide not to comply, what happens? I mean, presumably they can be sued by workers, but there's also federal and state official things that can be done?
This is a wonderful question because this is really the next step. How is this law going to be enforced? Because you can have a law in the books and it can be meaningless. Because of a Supreme Court decision, Epic Systems, the mandatory arbitration agreements that Uber and Lyft drivers have to sign keep these cases out of court. And so it's hard to have enforcement through a class action. We're really going to have to rely on private enforcement in this context. What is pretty impressive about this bill is that it makes clear that city attorneys and the California Attorney General can file for an injunction if there is not compliance. And so it takes it out of sort of the politics of the Labor Commissioner's office and puts it in city attorneys' hands.
So the cities have the leverage to sue non-compliant companies.
That's right. And let me tell you what happens if you violate an injunction is potential civil contempt. And judges have large leeway in defining what civil contempt means. It can mean, having execs in a holding cell. It can mean large financial penalties. The teeth of this bill, they're sharper than what we've seen in previous laws.
Getting a lot of different opinions. Let me just read someone from the other side. Curtis writes, labor rights have been eroding for decades. Union membership has declined. Real wages have flattened or fallen, and the middle class has all but disappeared. Kudos to the state legislature for recognizing how companies like Uber and Lyft are exploiting workers. Let me get another caller on, and that's Haz. Haz, welcome.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is about flexibility that Uber and Lyft are using as kind of a weapon to scare drivers into signing their stupid petitions that they're against AB 5. My experience as a full-time driver is that and just from looking at the situation is that basically that's a myth. The flexibility is like is basically. I get to choose which 12 hours a day I want to work, which 7 days a week. And they can't like stop, like McDonald's offers new employees this ability to work according to the schedule they want. They're not like dictating people's schedule, even at McDonald's. And McDonald's won't stop you from working at Burger King. I bet there's like a lot of people out there on the edge working at multiple fast food restaurants just trying to survive. So I think the flexibility thing is a myth, and I'd like to hear what...
Well, let me just ask you, were you pressured by Uber as an Uber driver in any way to come out against AB5?
Oh, yeah. They sent Uber and...
I'd like to know just, if I could, what the specifics of that were, if you could.
Well, I mean, we're completely controlled by the app. My algo is the boss. That's my slogan. The algo is my boss. The algorithm tells me everything to do. Basically, I'm completely controlled by Uber while I'm working for them. And I love driving. I don't mind being directed by the algorithm and everything. But there's countless mistakes that happen.
Except you know they would prefer no driver. I mean, they've already made that evident as far as driverless cars are concerned. But I appreciate hearing from you, Haz, and I thank you for the call. And let me bring on Luke Wake, who is going to be joining us. Luke Wake is a staff attorney with the National Federation of Independent Business, Small Business Legal Center. And Luke Wake, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's begin about your concerns, because I know you were involved in the Dynamex decision. AB5 essentially was codified as a result of that, and it was designed to do simply the kinds of things that we're talking about now. But in many ways, you feel small businesses are getting the short end of the stick here?
Yeah, in many ways, I'd say the small business community was left behind. So much of this discussion is framed this as an Uber-Lyft issue, but in reality, I'm talking to small business owners, and ever since the Dynamex decision came down last year, of all different stripes, different industries, who are really concerned that this is going to mess up their ability either to be an entrepreneur and to be an independent business, or to work with folks the way they always have. So we have a number of concerns, especially about the government picking winners and losers here, and about ultimately this discouraging entrepreneurialism and making it more difficult for people to actually get off the ground.
You would like, I presume, a system that would say opt in or opt out, right?
Well, look, I think our optimal system would be a principled and simple to apply business to business exception. So by that, I mean, if I've gone through the efforts to actually set myself up as an LLC or an S Corp, there should be really a presumption at that point that I'm a legitimate business, that I can be treated as a contractor, you know, of course, it could be rebuttable. Or say I've gone through the process of actually acquiring a business license and a taxpayer ID. I've got a website. I'm holding myself out to the world as being in business with business cards and trying to get my name out there. I should be treated as an entrepreneur. You know, if it's a sham, well, that's a different story. But the presumption should be if people have gone through those steps and they actually want to be entrepreneurs, they should be treated as such. They're independent economic actors.
So AB5 is bad for entrepreneurship. I'm getting that message from you. But there are exemptions here. There are a number of them. For example, travel agents and insurance brokers and dentists, hairstyles. You know, how do you decide? But part of the problem, I think, and what's murky for many people is how is the decision made who should be and should not be exempt?
Well, I mean, you know, Bismarck famously said that, you know, watching law being made is like watching sausages. The process isn't pretty. And this really was a case where I think the process isn't pretty because it's a civics lesson. We see where certain special interests were successful. The legislature picked winners, and implicitly, whoever it chose not to give a carve out to, whoever did not give an exemption from the ABC task force, you were a loser. It's going to be a lot harder for you. So, you know, we surveyed our members. You know, this is small business owners across the state of California, all different industries, and they were overwhelmingly opposed to the government, you know, picking and choosing winners in this fashion. And they really wanted to see, again, the legislature, you know, go with a more principled solution that would enable legitimate entrepreneurs to freely engage their services really across industry lines. So that's the sort of solution we were hoping to see. And we really, you know, concerned. I mean, this does nothing to help a lot of our members. And I can give you some concrete examples. You know, we've got, I mean, just one concrete example. I spoke with a woman a while ago who runs, you know, is a photographer, and this is how she likes to make her living. And she occasionally likes to work with a beautician. The beautician, of course, is, you know, puts on makeup for her clients and does their hair and stuff. And, you know, this has been a good working relationship. But when the Dynamex decision came down, that really threw a wrench in things because suddenly, she had real concerns about whether she was possibly going to face a lawsuit for continuing to, you know, treat this beautician as an independent contractor. And really, ultimately, that comes down to how the courts are going to define the quote-unquote usual course of business under the B prong of this ABC test. And, of course, that's the really difficult prong for people. And, unfortunately, AB5, by the way, does nothing to define and provide clarity on this question of what is the usual course of business. So you're going to see a whole lot of litigation about that. But, you know, if I'm this photographer and I have concerns, I'm going to err on the side of treating them as an employee because I don't want to risk a ruinous lawsuit. And, you know, here again, this is where I'm getting back to this idea that it does, you know, create some difficulty for someone who actually wants to stand out as an entrepreneur. I'm not going to risk losing my house over, you know, trying to treat someone as an independent contractor when it's going to be a close call.
Luke Wake again is staff attorney with National Federation of Independent Business, Small Business Legal Center. Coming up on a break, but Katie Orr, built into or baked into this bill, and the gig is not up, as somebody says, necessarily at this point, but retroactivity with liability going back 4 years?
Yes. The retroactivity is also another major concern for the small business community. You know, our guys are scared to death constantly of lawsuits, and there's so many ways you can be hit.
All right, we are coming up on a break, but when we return, we'll hear more from you, our listeners. California legislature has passed AB5. Trying to find out what it means for you and what it means particularly for those who are independent contractors and workers. And well, the landscape is changing. Katie Orr with us, politics and government reporter for KQED. Vina Dubal here in studio, associate professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law. And Luke Wake just joined us, staff attorney with the National Federation of Independent Business, Small Business Legal Center. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the fact that the California legislature passed yesterday AB5 and talking about what it means for you and what's in it. And Katie Orr with us, Vina Dubal and Luke Wake. And we'll get to as many of your calls as we can. Lots of people have questions. In fact, here's one from Joe who says, I used to deliver newspapers when I was a kid and know that I could not support a family on my earnings, so I'm in support of paying these people a living wage. What will be the impact on the newspaper business? Should mention here, Katie, I want to go to you on this, that just late Tuesday, separate legislation was actually introduced to allow a 1-year delay for the newspaper delivery drivers. But can you enlighten us more on that?
Yeah, it's interesting because this was kind of a late push we saw from newspapers that their delivery men and women might be affected by AB5. And it was kind of interesting because people said this really points to something that Luke was saying earlier. If you are savvy and you have enough resources to, you know, and enough power to contact the lawmaker and get an exemption, you can be successful in that. We saw these newspaper companies, really, I believe it was the last amendment made to the bill that, I'm sorry, that was a different negotiation. It was one of the last negotiations they took because this will not be a part of AB5. It's a separate piece of legislation that they're going through to give this carve out to newspaper delivery people. But people, you know, observers were saying, these newspapers, all they have to do is like publish editorials in these big papers and say, hey, this isn't fair. This is going to ruin our business. And that, of course, gets the attention of the lawmakers. Whereas somebody who might just be a freelancer and doesn't have all those same connections is kind of stymied about how to even go about getting one. So it's an example of where you are, your standing in society kind of makes a difference when you're trying to get an exemption from this bill.
Yeah, Vina Dubois, you want to weigh in here?
You know, my take on the exemptions here is different. I have the exemptions in front of me. The majority of exemptions from AB5 are people who have who make a lot of money. Doctors, accountants, psychologists, podiatrists, veterinarians, lawyers, architects, engineers. They make up the vast majority of exemptions. California employment law protections are there for people who are the most vulnerable. And so, you know, I see the exemptions as being actually quite principled. I will say that I wanted to see an exemption or at least a delay in having this law go into effect in the taxi industry because of how decimated the taxi industry has been. And
because of Uber and Lyft.
Because of Uber and Lyft. And I made my case and I did not get that exemption. So my experience with this particular legislator is that she was actually very principled. And in fact, freelance writers are exempt from this bill if they submit less than 35 times per year to any one entity. So if the San Francisco Chronicle has a writer who is writing more than 35 pieces for the Chronicle, then this bill would make that person an employee.
Well, here's a question right on target.
Sure.
I want to have you address. Susan writes, I'm a freelancer, back of the book indexer. I don't want to pick between authors and publishers and have to do whatever books they want or show up in an office. Right now, I can work wherever I want, whenever I want. I also don't consider myself a gig worker. Does this bill affect true freelancers like me?
Not if you are feeding one media company. So if you submit less than 35 times per year to any one entity, you are exempt from this.
And if I could go back to you, Luke Wake, with another listener question. This listener says, no one is addressing whether there is a distinction made for part-time versus full-time work. Does this all only affect people working 35 to 40 hours a week? Surely this doesn't require small businesses suddenly to provide health care and workers' compensation for a few hours of work a week.
Well, that's a great question. And look, I can give a concrete example of how this is, you know, really problematic for some businesses I've talked to. We have some businesses in our organization who connect people, you know, hospitals, local government, wherever, with linguists when they need something interpreted, right? And that often is a very short-term project. And that company might call someone up once in a blue moon to you know, provide their services. And by the way, that person is enjoying the flexibility to work for many other people. They have many other, you know, companies that they're performing that service for. And it's going to be a real hassle because, yes, they do have to treat them under, you know, they're under the ABC test. They're going to be viewed as an employee. And they're going to have to, you know, go through all of that onboarding process, the I-9s. It's a lot of red tape to deal with for a, you know, short-term project and truly a headache. And then on top of that, you got to worry about, you know, and talking about meal and rest breaks and stuff for someone who's just there for maybe, you know, half a day. It's a lot of additional work in addition to, you know, taking away the flexibility for these other people. It's an administrative nightmare for businesses that have a lot of these short-term gigs.
Luke Wake, again, a staff attorney in the Small Business Legal Center for the National Federation of Independent Business. And here is Andres. Andres, you're on. Good morning.
Hey, Mike. Good morning, everybody. Yeah, I've been an independent contractor working as an interpreter and translator in courts and the med legal system and all over conferences. I enjoy my freedom of being an independent contractor, working my hours, and I work for, you know, dozens of companies throughout the state, throughout the country, and even throughout the world. And I don't know why they're lumping us interpreters into this bill. We don't want it. We gathered thousands of signatures saying we don't want to be. We've been talking to our senators, writing to our senators. We've written to the author of the bill. Please don't bully us into being employees. We don't want to be employees. I mean, doesn't anybody get the message? Thank you, Mike.
All right, thank you. I'll let that statement stand. Although, Katie, I want to go back to you because getting a lot of questions from people who are wondering, do they indeed belong in the category or not? For example, here's a listener who says, does this affect in-home support of service workers and other caregivers who work for agencies as independent contractors?
Well, and I think there are concerns about those questions in the legislature as well, particularly yesterday when the assembly was taking its final vote on the measure before sending it to the governor. There were a lot of Democrats who stood up and said, I'm going to vote for this legislation, but there is a lot in this that we need to fix. You know, people were concerned about jobs within their districts and how people in their districts were going to be responding. And a lot of people were saying this is something they anticipate having to keep working on and going back and cleaning up and clarifying for potentially years to come because its implications are so huge. And I think we'll see a lot more of these. You know, we'll see bills to give carve-outs to people like interpreters and other businesses and professions who feel they were left out of the original AB 5. I anticipate covering it for many sessions.
Gives new meaning to devil in details, doesn't it? In fact, Vina Dubal, here's a listener who tweets, trucking isn't gig work. Please discuss trucking, how this will affect California's industry and economy.
Yeah. So trucking has been a particular thorn in the side of I think the AB 5 authors. It doesn't prevent, AB 5 does not prevent owner operators from doing business. It just prevents companies from misclassifying them as independent contractors when they're actually functioning as employees of the company. So there are lots of ways in which both companies and drivers can truckers can respond to this. AB 5 basically empowers the independent owner operators by removing the middleman or broker and allowing the drivers to set their own rates and entering into contracts directly as a business. Truckers can choose to sell their trucks and become employees, or they can become employees while owning the truck and receiving full reimbursement. And others may decide that they want to be independent contractors, and they can engage in creating sort of small businesses with other workers, driver collectives with other workers. There's a lot that this bill does to actually incentivize the type of market firm that fights inequality, like collectives
and unions.
And I think it means that the brokers cannot deny all responsibility for the welfare of the driver who is doing all of the work and bearing all of the costs. I think that truck drivers will ultimately be benefited by this.
Vina Dubal again is associate professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law. And our next caller up here is Evan. Evan, join us. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My focus is on the biotech industry, which is enormous in the San Francisco Bay Area, where the company that I happen to work for has permanent employees that do the science and the research. They also have contractors where they contract either through an in-house contracting firm or external temporary agencies, which is what I am in the process of being. And I'm concerned about how this bill would affect me. And then in addition, my wife is a contractor. She's a speech therapist at a school. And she has a very similar situation where she works for a speech therapy agency. She's been placed in a school for the last 5 years, yet she, you know, she prefers to be a contractor because she pays more. She gets paid more.
Let me go again to you, Katie, if I can.
Yeah, I think, again, with this particular caller, it gets back to what he is exactly doing for the company. And I think that's something we're going to be seeing a lot of, like, litigation on, too. If you work for a biotech company, really working for them, are you contributing to their core service, or are you, is it justifiable for them to call you a contractor? I think that's going to be a question that will be, you know, hashed out a lot. And I believe, maybe Vina can talk a little bit more about this, but I believe there is room in the law for like subcontracting between two businesses. So if his wife is a speech pathologist working with a speech pathologist company who contracts with the school, there might be some wiggle room in there. I don't know if Vina can speak more to that.
Is that your point, Vina Dubon?
Yeah, you know, that there is a referral agency that exemption that meets this criteria. I should also point out that folks in the tech industry who are contract workers are not actually contract workers. They're not independent contractors. They are employees of the staffing agency. So they are getting all of the benefits of employment already.
And here's Ross, who writes, if we had a universal health care system, much of the worker needs-based bills like this would be moot. Did you want to add something here, Luke Wake?
Could you repeat the question? I'm sorry.
Well, we were talking specifically about something a little bit out of your bailiwick. I thought I heard your voice, though. Let me bring another caller on, and that's Jim. Jim, go ahead.
Hi, this is Jim in Sunnyvale. I am a contractor in the Silicon Valley. I get paid with a 1099. I'm told by my state senator's staff that to get the engineering exemption, I have to be a professional engineer, a certified engineer. But most of us down in the Silicon Valley are not. We're just degreed engineers. So am I affected by this law?
Vina Dubon?
You know, I'm not sure. I know that engineers do have an exemption. I don't know the specifics of how one might have to be considered an engineer under the bill. I'm sorry, I can't answer that question.
Well, maybe somebody can, and we'll hope to hear from whomever that person may be. But let me thank the caller and go to another call. And let's bring Tom on next, who's joining us from San Rafael. Tom, welcome to the forum program.
Hi, thank you so much. Thank you for taking my call. I'm an independent musician, and I'm curious as to what AB5, what sort of impact that might have on music from both the production standpoint as well as the live performance standpoint and venues and that sort of a thing.
Yeah, we're getting a number of callers inquiring about music performances. Can you help us, Professor Dubon?
Well, artists are exempt. But again, if you're a musician, say, that is playing for one particular nightclub and they are treating you as a contractor, then you might have a problem. But if you're a musician and you play different gigs at different venues, you really don't have to worry about this. This bill is really about folks who are so clearly misclassified because they are repeat players with the same employer, and the employer is just not giving them the benefits of employment. So I think you're okay.
I do want to go back to you, Luke Wake, and find out what your thought is about maybe a preference to this. I mean, particularly where exemptions are concerned, it should be, in your judgment, done how or operated in what way?
Well, look, there's a couple ways that we could have done this a lot more simply, and the nature of the questions that you've been featuring here recently show how much of a litigation bonanza we're going to see here. I mean, this is very complicated, and there's going to be a lot of, we're going to have to do a lot of explaining to folks to even begin to understand who is and who's not, but there's going to be a lot of lawsuits and a lot of gray areas about whether or not someone does or does not fit within that exception, and I think businesses are going to be smart to err on the side of caution if it's a gray area because they don't want to be hit with a lawsuit. It could have been done a lot more simply. For one, California could have chosen, if they wanted to, have an ABC test It could have rejected the version of the ABC test, the especially rigid version that the California Supreme Court gave us by basically judicial fiat in the Dynamex decision, and instead adopted the ABC test that most other states apply, that is just a little bit more flexible for folks who actually want to be an entrepreneur. The other option would have been, as proposed by Senator Shannon Grove and NFIB supported this bill, to actually align California law with federal law on this issue. For the purposes of wage and hour law, federal law, the U.S. Department of Labor has for a long, long time applied what they call the economic realities test, which considers a number of factors and is somewhat flexible and is very, I think, friendly at the end of the day to workers. But that test ultimately looks to, well, to what extent is this person actually economically dependent on the hiring entity. And I think that would have made a lot of sense to align us and bring us into conformance with that federal standard. Of course, that's not what they chose to do. And I've already said, the business-to-business exception that was, simple and principled would have been a very good step. Instead, what they do offer here, a narrow business-to-business exception. But it's very complicated to qualify for. There's a whole bunch of requirements to even begin to, say that you fall under that. And one of those I would highlight is that the services have to be performed directly to the contracting business rather than to the customers of the contracting business. So,
in fact, I was going to ask you about this thing that came to be known as the Borrello test. That was multiple factors to decide if a contractor should be considered an employee. I believe it came out of San Jose. We're talking about, does the company supply tools and equipment to get the work done? Is the work performed at the company? Those are pretty straightforward.
Well, for one, the Borrello test, when that applied historically before Dynamex, was a balancing test. So it would ask a number of questions, and it was a weighing process, and that allowed some degree of flexibility. But to qualify for this very narrow business-to-business exception in this enactment, there's no flexibility about it. You've got to satisfy all of the requirements that are listed. And for example, having your own tools and supply, that was a factor that weighed in favor of viewing someone as an independent contractor before, but it wasn't absolutely 100% necessary. It was one of several considerations. Here it's an absolute requirement. And again, this notion that the services have to be performed directly to the contracting business as opposed to its customers. Well, what about the small business owner I talked to recently who runs a service that helps connect people with, they've locked their key in their car and they can't get in? Well, he connects them with a locksmith. Now, I know that there's another provision of this law that deals with referral agencies, but it defines referral agencies in a very sort of narrow, weird way that people who do event planning, minor home repair, moving, that sort of thing would qualify. But I don't see anything there that would help my small business owner who's helping people with being locked out of their cars. So.
And you want to weigh in here, Vina Dubo?
I just wanted to speak to this business-to-business, lack of business-to-business exception and give you an example. So Alexander v. FedEx, it was an important Ninth Circuit decision that found that FedEx had been misclassifying their drivers, their home delivery drivers, under the Borrello test, which was the original California test on whether or not someone is an employee. And FedEx spent over $1 billion in litigating this multi-state litigation. The Ninth Circuit said, no, you are controlling these workers under this test. And what FedEx did was say, okay, drivers, we're going to have a new contract. You actually are now independent businesses, and you have to hire X number of employees. And what it did was make it so that instead of having these workers have really have basic, low-wage workers have basic protections, it made it so that they were making even less money. And so this is actually not, I think there's some hysteria around this test. It is actually much more clear than the Borrello test.
The Borrello test is pretty murky.
It is very murky, and it's subject to ideological interpretation. There is much less of that here with the ABC test. And it prevents businesses that are ill-intentioned, that are anti-competitive, from misclassifying their workers using a business-to-business exception.
And we bring on another caller. Jake, that's you. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just kind of wanted to speak to essentially how I'm a Lyft driver of 2 years, and every year when it comes to tax season, essentially, you know, I have to find every single receipt. And I just kind of wanted to ask, how essentially this is going to be affecting how drivers do their taxes from, like, now on, essentially.
Professor Dubow, can you help this gentleman?
Yeah. One of the things that this business model does is it passes all of the risk and the burdens of doing business onto the workers. And if Lyft and Uber and these companies decide to, comply with AB 5 voluntarily, then you won't have to do all of that work. They will be doing that work for you. And so it'll be much easier come tax season.
Oh, that's one positive light on this, and let me thank the caller for that. We've got a lot of comments coming in here, actually a lot of questions, too. As I said earlier, Suzanne wants to know, how will this affect gig companies' responsibility to provide insurance to their drivers? We lost our car insurance while driving for Instacart because we didn't know we needed insurance here in California. Can you shed any light on that, Katie Orr? Do you know what went on in the legislature?
Well, if you're considered an employee, the company would have to provide things. That is something they would have to deal with. For instance, if I am working for KQED and I drive my car for them, I have to provide. I have to give them my mileage and all of this stuff. And there are certain rules and regulations I have to follow. I have to give them a copy of my driver's license. If I'm driving a KQED vehicle, then I have to follow the certain rules that they have. And I think that's been one of the criticisms of these companies is that you have this car that you're required to buy for these companies and there's upkeep and maintenance and all of that that isn't covered by these companies and it's expensive for these workers.
And this I'm sorry, please finish.
No, so I was just going to say, that will all be things that they need to figure out. And to the author's point, those are things that companies like KQED and other businesses already deal with. So why should companies like Uber and Lyft be exempt?
Yeah, there's still a lot to figure out here, as you've been implicating. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we will go to more of your calls. Let me go next to you, Jan. Thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I have been working for Uber, DoorDash, and Grubhub for 5 months now. And I can tell you I can no longer do it. For one, I didn't know about the insurance. So the insurance companies are cracking down on drivers. They said if they catch anybody driving without having commercial insurance policy, that they would be penalized. I can just tell you, I've been charged $263 on top of what I was paying already. And it's just over $400 I pay per month just to drive, not to mention the gas and the wear and tear. Uber and DoorDash seem to send their drivers anywhere and everywhere. Send you, for example, if you're in Dublin, they'll send you to San Jose or Fremont or send you out to Walnut Creek. It's crazy if you follow these algorithms. And also we found out.
So forgive me, Jan, you're giving it up, huh? That's what I heard.
Yes, I can't do it. It's too expensive.
I'm sorry that you're enduring all that.
I'm paying more for gas, wear and tear on the car, and it just doesn't pay enough. To have a commercial license it's so expensive. It's as if you're a trucking company and you're just an individual who's trying to make a few dollars. And
I hope you can find something else because it sounds like you've been through the ringer here. And I appreciate your letting us know about your experiences. I want to actually go to some more questions and experiences that other listeners are weighing in on. A listener writes, as a substitute teacher who basically works every day of the school year but is not able to receive teacher health benefits, would I be included? Can you help us here, Vina Dubow?
Hmm. That's an interesting legal question. Yes.
That's why I asked you.
Yeah. So I don't hold me to this, but I think that under this test, substitute teachers who would be considered employees of the school district. Now, whether or not she gets the same benefits as regular teachers, I think is subject to both the union contracts and to the discretion of the Board of Education. But she would get the basic benefits that that workers get as employees under California law.
And a question for your legal expertise, Luke Wake. A listener wants to know, will companies be able to limit worker hours to minimize benefit liabilities typically provided to full-time employees?
Well, generally, look, California makes the employment, it's nothing is more heavily regulated than the employer-employee relationship in California, which is one reason why a lot of folks would prefer to work with independent contractors. But generally speaking, you do have some prerogative to set your hours, you know, for employees and so forth, as long as you're treating employees consistently and not not doing whatever you're doing for, you know, discriminatory reasons and so forth. But that is an issue that, you know, you know with the rise of, say, predictive scheduling and things like that. I mean, there's going to be some complications going forward. But right now, employers can, generally speaking, set the hours for their employees.
Well, Katie Orr, we've got seconds left here. This goes to the governor's desk. Like you said, he's pretty much endorsed it and indicated that he's probably going to sign it. But we've got a lot of details, obviously, to get through here. And the author of the bill, Lorena Sanchez, has said that she wants to maybe create some hybridization or get some people involved now and help them in different ways. There's lots ahead, obviously, huh?
Yeah, and I should say Lorena Gonzalez is the author. And yeah, like I said earlier, this is not an issue that is just going to go away. We're going to be dealing with like the details and, you know, parsing out distinctions, I think, for different professions for, I mean, years to come.
Well, on that note, we will have to conclude here. Thank you, Katie Orr. Always good to have you aboard. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Katie Orr is politics and government reporter for KQED. Thank you, Vina Dubal. Good to have you here with us in studio. Vina
Thanks.
Dubal, again, is associate professor of law at UC Hastings College of Law. I thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, Luke Wake. Luke Wake is staff attorney with National Federation of Independent Business, Small Business Legal Center. Appreciate your being with us, Luke.
Thank you.
And appreciate you, our listeners, being with us here. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, Monday through Friday. Indeed. Today's the end of my work week, but another hour of Forum is up ahead. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis. Through June 14, 2020, the museum presents New Era, Doug Aitken's immersive installation that pushes the limits of perception.